AW Masters, reel 18.
Now, any ram that was left in the vehicle for the people away on duty, out of the ship for any reason at all, would be taken up to the officer of the watch and kept under the supervision of the quarterdeck staff so they could be dealt with on their men returned to the ship, usually somewhere about 5 o'clock at night, you see. There was a specified time for it anyway, dependent on the ship you was in. But trafficking in rum, the same as trafficking in anything else, even tobacco in those days, you see, was a shilling a pound. And it sounds silly, but people used to do all sorts of funny things about it. But rum was a thing, you see, that it was definitely discouraged from saving it. The only people who had rum worth saving were chief and petty officers. Well, if they wanted a bottle of tot, they had to keep it to themselves. They mustn't let the folk next door know. You see, it wasn't a case of losing it, but there was always a possibility of that causing trouble. You see, if a person, was going to abuse the issue of neat rum to the point of giving it away for a job to be done, the person who does that rum the first time looks for it the next time. And if it isn't there, there's all sorts of bad feeling, you see. And not only that, it's what we used to consider to be an abuse of privilege, which it is. And of course, we used to look at it in the light that if you're once allowed an abuse of privilege, you're liable to lose the privilege. See, the Navy no longer draws rum. They're not men enough to look after it. They're not men enough to drink it. That's the answer.
There would be quite a lot of people who didn't take rum, who didn't drink it.
Well, in those days, they used to get, in the early days, they used to get 3 halfpence a day.
3 halfpence a day.
And then it went up to 3d.
And apart from those men who didn't take that and took the money instead, there would be others who would use the rum as a PAM, I mean, as a way of getting jobs done.
If it was allowed.
If it was allowed.
If you didn't know it, you see. But as I say, it was discouraged. Because in, we'll say chiefs and petty officers' messes, I'm not going to say people didn't try it. And I'm not going to say people didn't do it. Mm. But not if it was known. You just didn't allow it to happen.
Yeah.
Now, if you take the case of a destroyer, where the discipline would be different altogether. You see, in a destroyer, if you're in heavy weather, the rum there is kept right aft, and you've got to go right along the upper deck to get it down from the next compartment to the rudder. Well, in itself, it's hazardous even getting it. And then, the only way you can serve it out, you couldn't even mix it in a destroyer, see, because you hadn't got the facilities. So you had to serve out every man's tot personally. And you had it in gallon jars with a wicker carrier. And of course, once you get used to that, you can hold that under your arm quite easy, and you can pour a tot out as steady as being in a bar. But it isn't a case of being clever, but it's like everything else, it's experience, you see. But there again, you had to keep a 100% tally of what you've done. Because if you go down to the rum store today, it may be blowing half a gale. If you had an accident and dropped that, you've got to get a witness that that has broken, it's gone. And that could be replaced. But God help the man who went along and said he'd broken it, he hadn't. I mean, he didn't get a replacement at all. And it wasn't a case of penalties or anything of that, but you had an inbred, care with the treatment of rum especially, because it's a thing that can so easily be abused.
And the men looked forward to the tot, I believe.
Definitely.
It was a great...
Well, under all sorts of conditions. I mean, if it was in heavy weather, wet weather, fog, snow, in the tropics, in the Baltic, froze in, wherever you might be, under every condition known to science, a tot saved many a man's life.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that literally. Good God, I've seen people absolutely fall over themselves. See, and during the Second War, for instance, when we had all these trawlers on minesweeping, well, you had a different type of man, absolutely undisciplined to start with. And I had one man come to me one day, I said, "What's the matter with you?" He said, "I'm after me rum." I said, "You're early, aren't you?" "I want it." Broad Aberdeen accent. "Oh," I said, "you used to rum?" Aye. I thought to myself, "You wait a minute. Well, I have the total jurisdiction over this rum. So I got the rum when it was issued, you see, and I got it in a glass. So I said, you used to drink in Rome? He said, aye. I said, drink that then. No water. He said, I never have water. I said, I didn't say you did. I said, that's rum and not water. He did. He took it back.
Church services were part of the tradition, part of the job.
Divine service, yes.
Divine service was there, sure. And it was arranged so that English Church of England here, Roman Catholics, had their own in a big ship.
If it carried a parson, yes.
Yes. And as far as you were concerned, the church was just, the service was part of the life of the Navy. It didn't mean much either.
Oh, yes, it did. Yes, in that, well, I suppose it's one of those things, you see, it was like divisions. After divisions, you went to church, and then from church to carry on normal duties. But you came across so many instances in Navy life, in those days even, where an accident occurred, or death, or might have been a ship lost, or any one of the thousand and one things you do come across. And you live very close to nature. And I mean, it wasn't a case of being extra religious or in any way saintly in your conduct, but it was a case of you realised how close you was to whatever a church implies.
So that,
and I mean that with due respect to whatever religion anyone has.
And you attended services regularly on board then, and you felt quite strongly about the...
No, I didn't feel too strongly to the point of it being a necessity or have to do it, but it was a matter of routine,
yes.
You see, and you didn't object to being there in any way. As I say, when you... under various conditions, you come across. I was in one ship, for instance. We had 5 suicides in 6 months. Personal reasons in every case, as far as we knew. But I mean, that sort of thing left an impression. And I know the captain of the ship at that time. He said to me personally, he said, "You know, in a village, for instance, he said 5 deaths in 6 months wouldn't be taken any notice of." He said, "But here we're different." I agree, we were. Because you're in a small community and you know everybody and everybody knows you. And I mean, for 5 men to be lost out of a ship's company in that small period, they weren't all suicides. There was 3 deaths by various happenings, but there were 2 suicides amongst the 5. And as I say, your whole phase of life, you live a much closer to the realities of life, really, than you do in civilian life.
And the second thing, we talked briefly about the traditions of the Navy, and one of them, of course, was crossing the line ceremonies, which you remembered happening, not always, but not even everybody, but occasionally they went on.
Well, because there is the thing that happened in the bigger type of ship. You see, I mean, if he was in a destroyer or a sloop or anything of that nature, well, you could cross and recross and you didn't take any notice of it, you see. I mean, that sloop I was in, for instance, we were dodging across the line day after day, zigzagging and doing all sorts of funny things. Well, it meant nothing. But you take the ceremonial occasions, such as these big ships that would, say, take the royal family, or in those days did, the Prince of Wales going around the world, or if he was in a big ship that was on passage, it would be organised merely to break the routine, you see, break the monotony of day after day at sea. And, I mean, there it was done up as a, well, what shall I say, more like a circus. It was arranged, you see, with the various powers that be, and everybody who hadn't been before or hadn't got a certificate to say you'd been across the line, you was expected to go through the ceremony. And, of course, at the end of the day, you simply said, well, what a bunch of damn fools we've been. But, as I say, it's just one of those things. It was a tradition, and dozens and dozens of times I crossed the line, and, of course, you thought no more about it.
Yes. The other thing I wanted just briefly to get a note from you on again was on things like Navy regattas, which were quite a major feature of life in the Navy in those days.
Oh, they were highly organised. And there would be a full programme of things happening, from 8 o'clock in the morning till after sunset. And these things were arranged on a basis of competition, naturally. And there was great rivalry between not only squadrons, but between ships, individual ships of squadrons. You see, possibly the battle fleet would go one place and they'd have a regatta of their own, and the destroyers would go elsewhere and they'd have a regatta, and then they'd all meet together, and Bob's your uncle and you've got the lot in.
And this would be quite a big celebration.
Oh, yes. I've seen an anchorage of, 3 miles square, covered with ships of all classes, sizes and shapes. And all the items taking place, and there was just a friendly rivalry, because the last one of the lot would be what they used to call the all-comers race, which, as the name implies, was any type of boat for every type of ship, and pulled in any sort of way. And that'd be about a 2 mile course, so you can imagine at the end of the 2 miles the ocean would be littered with boats and what have you. But because the prizes that they used to give in those days, the winning ship, the ship who gained most points, would have usually a big silver cock, which originated from the cock of the north that was given in the Grand Fleet during the First War. I think it was a Valiant introduced it, but anyway, whichever one it was, they had a beautiful Rhode Island Red. He was a beauty. And he used to be in a up on the superstructure, and he kept the boys alive. But from there, you see, it altered, and the last one I saw in the Mediterranean, the big silver one, God knows what it cost. But of course, the trophies that ships carried in those days, you know, had to be seen to be believed. Oh, there's some marvellous stuff.
Such as?
Table centres, for instance, huge silver enamel. A lot of it was given by the ships, by the places after which the ships were named, such as Weymouth, any individual place named after any town. And the Sussex, for instance, she had a bell, and it was the second largest silver bell in the Navy. It's now in Chichester Cathedral, same bell, but it lacks, they used to have a silver crown on the top of it in the ship, but that's gone now. At least it wasn't in the kitchen when I saw it. And the Nelson, she had the biggest one, which I expect now is in Portsmouth Barracks, which they've now named Nelson for some unknown reason. But those things meant a lot to the individual ships in which they were carried. You see, even destroyers, they always had a bell which was engraved with the name of the ship, and possibly with the people who presented it. And, I mean, in the service in those days, all brightwork was kept cleaned, and they used to look very, very nice.
Just to finish then, because that's quite interesting on traditions and things, you said that your foreign service was connected up, of course, and meshed together with your war service, in the First World War anyway.
Oh, yeah.
What did men feel about overseas service? Was it something you had to do? Had you just accepted the
No feeling about it. It was simply a case of you was in the service and that was that.
I presume it did a bit with age. I mean, certain men who were younger, people, you know, young boys, would be very keen to go. Perhaps men who were married might be a little bit less enthusiastic about it.
Well, yeah, there might be that, but I mean, nobody was reluctant to the point of refusing to go. Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. Because, I mean, in those days, for instance, that minesweeping business, you see.
Yes,
we were already in the Mediterranean when it finished. And we simply went from Gib to Malta with no idea of where, why or when. And we picked up the other two ships. And from Malta we sailed again to Portsend. And from there through the Suez. And then it became known that we was going to